Hi, Eve.
Hi, Anne.
Well, I'm Anne Althaus out here at the University of Wisconsin Law School in Madison, Wisconsin. And where are you?
I am in Washington, which is just about to unconstitutionally get a new vote in Congress. So I'm feeling very flush and proud of bilking
you
all.
Think you deserve to be represented in Congress?
We're about to apparently get our vote. The Senate passed it today, and it's going to the House next week after this will be posted.
It's only fair, but it's completely unconstitutional.
I don't want to jump on. I think we were set to talk about this later, but
No, we just did it. All right, yeah. I'm crossing that one off. We just did that. That's all I have to say. I don't have any detail to it because I can't even articulate the argument that it's constitutional to deal with it. I mean, the Constitution provides for the structure of Congress, and you can't add things to that unless they got to amend the Constitution. I think it's ridiculous. After all of these years of Democrats criticizing the Republicans or the Bush administration for shredding the Constitution, they just go in and do whatever they want. They want to do it. It needs to be done.
That's a fair way to put it. But I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so you have the advantage on this one, and I have to say, as far as I can tell, it does seem to probably be unconstitutional. It looks like it will get a legal challenge, and that they should do it through the route that's prescribed in the Constitution. Now, I guess the argument that I have read for its constitutionality, which I saw, there was some letter that it surprised me, Viet Dinh and a couple other conservative legal scholars signed, noting that, you know, we haven't always, particularly in the 20th century, been incredibly rigid about that definition of the people of the several states in Article I shall select the members of Congress or of the House. And the example that they gave was the treatment that we give citizens voting overseas. So if you're a citizen living overseas for a while, and you don't pay taxes in your state, and you have no intent to return, and you're really not governed or even really a resident of that state at all, you're not really a member of that state in any way other than totally arbitrary, and you are allowed to vote in that state in the senatorial congressional elections as long as you want to, is my belief. So,
but that's about voting, how you whether you remain a citizen of a particular place. You normally would retain your citizenship of one place until you acquired another one, and that's about voting qualifications. I think the idea that the states send various representatives to Congress, they are only the states that send representatives to Congress, and D.C. is not a state. There's no way that D.C. is a state within the meaning of the Constitution. I just think, and I also think it's just embarrassing to make stretched arguments to try to get something that they want.
I
should do it on the up and up and be constitutional about it. But I mean, obviously, since everyone knows that the D.C. representative would be a Democrat, it's very hard to get the kind of supermajority you would need to amend the Constitution. So I understand the sort of built-in dysfunction, but I don't think it's worth leaping over the words of the Constitution. Anyway, let's cross that off the topic.
On the other hand, you know, there's a lot of people who live in D.C. who have no conflict of interest with voting in a federal or senatorial or whatever election, and they, you know, they don't have a choice to move out of D.C. They live here. You know, it's not like myself where I could live in Clarendon or whatever if I wanted and vote. Yeah. In fact, I will admit, although, and this is, you know, this is just one of these unfortunate problems that not, you know, D.C. not having full voting rights produces. I hope that I don't get any kind of feds beating down my door in the morning, but I retained my Virginia permanent address voting for somewhat longer than was really kosher because I wanted to vote in the 2006 Jim Webb. You know, you get these senatorial races that, you know, seem to make some kind of greater difference than my ward alderman in D.C. And you know, I do think that you have a, I mean, it's not something to be totally poo-pooed. The problem
No, I agree
of
that
large,
it's completely unfair, and I don't like the fact that these people don't get to participate, but I think that for, you know, this portion of a state that was ceded to be the national capital without it really being intended that people would just live there in the normal way, I think that the best solution would be to reconnect it with one of the actual states and back as a part of, what is it, Maryland.
Is that something that would, how difficult would that be to do?
I think any of that ought to be done by constitutional amendment, but obviously in the current state, it seems so drastically unfair that it seems that something should be done. And maybe, I'm afraid that maybe no one will have standing to challenge it in court, and that in the end, Congress's view that it was constitutional will be the last word on it, and that if courts ever get it, they might say no one has standing, or they might say it's a political question, which would be a doctrine that could be used to allow the final word on the constitutionality of it to be determined by Congress. So if they vote for it, that would be the end of it.
Yeah,
so maybe that will happen. That would really shock me to see that.
It's so political. I mean, it's sort of hard to imagine a Supreme Court case not having the aspects of Bush v. Gore on ruling on this question, although maybe it could be risen above it. But it does. I mean, it's a thing you have to think about how to overcome, I think, because it is so unfair to those residents of Southeast or whatever.
I agree.
But you're just in a kind of eternal deadlock because...
But it's also unfair that the various states each get two senators. It's ridiculous that California has only two senators, New York has only two senators, and Wyoming has two, Delaware has two. It's absurd.
At least they get some, though.
I mean, there are a lot of really unfair things that are just
built
Wyoming,
in. I guess Wyoming, every person gets an arm, and in New York, they all get a pinky, but at least they get a body part.
Yeah, to get nothing at all is really a slap in the face, isn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, I feel... For myself, this has been a cause of the New Republic, actually, because we have an unusually large contingent of real D.C. natives. So our editor grew up in Northeast, went to D.C. schools. So have some of our other senior writers, our writer Jason Zengerly, and they're really hot on D.C. statehood, actually, but also now this vote.
Yeah, but you have something that's so small and that's so thoroughly associated with one party that makes it very hard to do anything.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's an argument in favor of returning parts of D.C. to Maryland, where at least you could sort of have the Eastern Shore and the rural West to kind of make it more of a legit conglomeration, so it's not just like as though you're giving New York City or the Upper West Side a senator, right? But
right. Well, if New York City were a separate state and then they got two senators, that would be very, I mean, it would be so much about the Democratic Party that it's, even if it seemed fair in terms of population, it wouldn't be tolerable politically, especially since you'd need a constitutional amendment. You need a supermajority. Why would the other side agree to that? You couldn't get enough votes.
No, of course, it would never be done. But it is, I mean, D.C. would be a state unlike any other state in its political composition, really. And there's something sort of weird about it. But give it back to Maryland. We should look into this because something must be done.
Give it back to Maryland. Yeah. Yes. So, but I wanted you to talk about, you've been writing a lot about the woeful state of the Republicans in Congress. I know you've written a lot about that, and I'm sort of, I just like to hear you talk about that, and I'll try to throw in a word here and there, but let's hear what you have to say.
It's particular interest to me, I guess in part because I grew up in a very conservative family. So while I myself have a mixed bag set of political views that end me up more on the liberal side, I have a lot of sympathy towards conservatism and towards the idea of a kind of intellectually vibrant or muscular conservative movement that really, you know, even if we have Barack Obama as president, really offers a serious pushback. And, you know, one thing
that you really want there to be a two-party system with the Republicans defined in a way that is, even if you wouldn't want to vote for it, that offered a counterbalance, that offered a choice that was distinctive and good in some way.
Absolutely. And I do think that, you know, it's such a strain with of political thought in this country that has such a strong tradition and is very American in certain ways. And I also mm-hmm. want it to be, you know, I sort of want it to be, I want the Republican Party to be a party that can appeal to, say, academics. And I know that can uh-huh. seem crazy being on a campus, and it hasn't been that way for a long time. And I think, you know, part of that is not its fault or whatever, but what you have right now and a party or a movement that can appeal to, people who are younger, people who are intellectual people. I mean, I don't want to cast aspersions on the GOP entirely right now. It has interesting people in it, but you know, it is, its main base is white Americans who are not poor, like, you know, just deeply destitute, but who have not finished college. And mm-hmm. I just think, and male also, and that's just, that demographic is dying. And I do think that, you know, an article that I wrote for us last week, now it will have been last mm-hmm. week when it's posted on, is on the McCainification of the GOP and how they're sort of rerunning McCain's techniques. And I thought of this because of the obsession with pork and the idea of countering the stimulus on the basis of it's pork and really going strong against earmarks being something that I just don't think the public cares about put that way very much.
You don't think that the public is disturbed by all this spending, or that a good portion of the public is anxious about the profligate spending, how all the normal rules have just fallen away, and it seems just to be just a shocking change from the norm?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're talking about the huge deficits, you know, these billions of numbers, people, the public opinion tends to be somewhat anti-stimulus, or when you hear the price tag, billions, trillions spent by the government. I saw an ad in the gym saying that if you spent $1 million every day from the time Jesus was born, you still wouldn't have right. spent as much as congressmen. I don't know who did that ad, but that kind of right. thing. That is,
and all these shocking numbers, like earmarks. It's more than the entire amount spent on the Vietnam War. It's more than the right. amount spent on every war ever. I don't know what some of these comparisons are, but it's as if money has suddenly lost all meaning. And all the things we've ever been saying about how you need to be careful about deficits and spending has all just completely evaporated on this assertion that there's an emergency. Suddenly, none of the rules apply. None of the normal sense of scale and about money applies anymore. We've just seemed to have descended into madness. Isn't there shouldn't the Republicans be defining themselves by that?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, you also don't want to be sort of naively populist about, oh, a billion sounds like a lot of money. I've never seen $1 billion in actuality. Like, well, those are the numbers that the U.S. government deals with. And, you know, you see even people like Marty Feldstein, GOP kind of guru economist, he said, we need a stimulus. This is not the right stimulus. He came out against the stimulus that was passed by Congress. Mm-hmm. But he said, mm-hmm. you know, it's pretty much concluded by most, although not all economists, that you do need to stimulate the economy via spending and care somewhat less about deficits in a time of severe economic downturn, which the indicators say that we're in, even if you're not, you know, going all Chicken Little and saying we're going to be in bread lines or trying to do scare tactics. And but the GOP, it's very, you know, it's kind of all or nothing. Like, they called for a spending freeze totally, which is just sort of, you know, why that? Why not a more Marty Feldstein intelligent look? We need a different kind of stimulus. Also, and then they also have been on this sort of jihad against pork and earmarks, which is such a small portion of what we're talking about. And it's a very McCain thing. Like, McCain.
Yeah, McCain always reverted to talking about the earmarks, and at some point so much DNA. Money was involved. The earmarks was such a small amount of money that was involved, right?
Yeah.
If you get rid of all the earmarks, it wouldn't make enough of a difference, and suddenly we were in this much larger problem, and McCain just seemed to be completely incapable of dealing with the problem that actually existed. He seemed to just fall back on these cliches or the things that he'd already established. They were completely out of proportion to the existing problem. I mean, I wasn't sure if I was going to vote for McCain or
lines.
Obama.
They were gimmicky.
Yeah,
Bear DNA, the 3 million for Bear DNA. It was like, I think that study actually turned out to be legit. A, B, yeah. 3 million compared to entitlement. I mean,
Seems just anti-science that there is sort of like, well, anybody doing a study of anything, it's ridiculous. It seems sort of anti-education, anti-science, and it doesn't make a very. I mean, I wish they would. Just seem more competent and more intelligent, more based on facts. I mean, there's certainly material in conservatism to do that. So I agree with you that seeming like McCain is just terrible. I mean, I didn't vote for McCain in the end because of the economics issue. I just thought he didn't seem to know what he was doing. And that the stunt of calling off the campaign was just fatal.
Yeah, and it's the same kind of gimmicky, like the sort of the pride. Now, as you... No, as everyone knows, House Republicans voted totally unilaterally against the stimulus. And, you know, there were reasons. Again, I look at the Marty Feldstein op-ed, which I thought was at least an intelligent way to put an opposition to the stimulus. If, you know, even for someone who supports the stimulus as it was drawn up, I can say, you know, it seemed like a plausible, reasonable piece. As a Republican, there were legitimate reasons to vote against the stimulus, but then they took this kind of unseemly sort of esprit de corps, obsessed kind of grotesque pride in the fact that they had, a group of zealots at Masada kind of done this last stand, hold the line, not a single one. They're so proud of the fact that, they all voted against the stimulus and, at their house retreat, they showed a video memorializing their moment of resistance, voting against the stimulus, and they all broke into applause. And they showed a clip from the movie Patton, and that just it did remind me of the McCain stunt, like just these sort of this kind of I'm swooping in, we're doing this, we're riding in on our horses and making this great stand and. And then when it comes down to it, you're not entirely sure what it means or why it should even matter that you did it in such a dramatic way. It's the melodrama. I mean, it's just
laughable. Well, I mean, I certainly think
laughable.
That the whole situation is so important that to turn it into to do anything that seems lightweight or cheesy is a bad idea. But I do think that it was right for the Republicans to say this is where we need to define ourselves and to reject bipartisanship. I think that was the right thing to do. And to say, well, you don't need our votes. You can do everything you want to do without us. So go ahead. You do it. You take ownership of it. And the Democrats, if they're actually doing the right thing, should be pleased to take full ownership of it. If it works, they'll be able to take credit. And if it doesn't work, the Republicans can say they were right. I think it's good to have two parties. I don't have a problem with them withholding their votes. And I think if the tables were turned, the Democrats would have done the same thing. But, I do agree with you about if they do it in a stunt-like way, it's not very inspiring, just like I don't think McCain was inspiring. And they need to project a competence, that they know what they're doing with the economy better than the Democrats. But they could have done that better. But in the end, I like them defining themselves as not the Democrats and rebuilding what conservatism is. You know, I'm interested in, you said you grew up in a conservative family. I'm interested in the details of your family and how they, and the kind of conservatism that they projected. I'm not sure how long ago that was, but
of course.
Talk about that a little?
Sure, and then that segues perfectly into something that I wanted to ask you. My father worked for Reagan. That's how we ended up in the Washington area. I grew up in Virginia.
Oh. What did he do?
He was some kind of deputy undersecretary for humanitarian. He was in the State Department.
What, you don't know what his job was?
He was in the State Department for Humanitarian Affairs and Human Rights, and I do know that he worked directly under Wolfowitz and Elliot Abrams. And
cool.
So those are, you know, it's...
And he couldn't make you into a conservative.
No, and I'm considered like a great sort of disaster because it's interesting, you know, when I was growing up, we went, my family is Jewish, I'm Jewish, and we went every year to Passover Seder and also frequently to Yom Kippur break fast at Elliot Abrams' house. And Bill Kristol would be there with his family, and Wolfowitz was not really part of that set, but it was Kristol and a guy named Hillel Fradkin, who helps run the Hudson Institute, who's fascinating kind of Middle East scholar, Krauthammer occasionally. And the discussions, you know, these people were very conservative. They were neoconservatives, really, entirely. But
in a way that you admired and you thought they defined conservatism in a good way, even though you disagreed with it in the end?
Yeah, and I sort of fell off the wagon and part on social issues, on gay rights and things like that. That was the beginning of the split.
Clearly, conservatives could be socially liberal. I mean, that's so easily within reach of conservatives.
That's true, although
Isn't
these,
it?
Yeah, although you...
They can never win unless they drag along these horrible social issues.
That's true, and I think that sort of consorting with the devil on this and being such a part, you know, people like Kristol, especially now, really became part of the movement conservatism, and they had to ally themselves very closely with the Christian right. And, you know, I think they came to love some of these people for the support that they felt on Israel from evangelicals. And they came to view their views on things like gay marriage, gay rights, other social issues, abortion, whatever, as, you know, they were seduced to some degree by those views. And they also have a sort of, you know, they were admirers of Buckley and the sort of stand athwart history, screaming stop. So when you, you know, they wouldn't want to rush into something like gay marriage, you know, with, done by the courts or whatever. But
yeah.
But they were, and so, you know.
So there's a fascination with tradition and the idea of changing things too quickly.
Right, and Burkean.
Yeah.
But my mother at a certain point.
You say that with such a sneer.
Oh, no. I don't say it with a sneer. You know, I'll have a Burke lapel pin.
Because I think some of that is appealing. I think some of the idea that you can't change things too quickly or you have to be considerate of the people who are, and appreciative of the people who are deeply rooted in tradition, even if they haven't picked up the latest trends and who you're not supposed to hate anymore, how free you're supposed to be.
I think it's just really reality, and you know, you think of it in immigration, I'm probably as liberal as they get on immigration, comprehensive immigration reform, but you look at a community like some of these small towns in Georgia or North Carolina, where within 3 years it's gone from, you know, being this sort of slightly kind of old school homespun, everyone knows each other, it's all like all white, to being 30% Hispanic, and it's no surprise that you would get a not so great reaction. I mean, it's a shock, right? And to expect this community to just say, oh, you know, I'm so pleased at the diverse way that our community has transformed. Like, that's, it's not realistic. So, but you know, this was sort of the intellectual milieu, but then also my mother, at a certain point, she had an extreme anaphylactic reaction to Bill Clinton and became a huge, huge ditto head. And so I also listened to Rush Limbaugh every day growing up for, you know, whatever, 3 hours a day.
I like to listen to Rush Limbaugh. Wait, so your mother was liberal initially?
No, she grew up in Brooklyn as a Jew, you know. But she also had...
So she was in that same Weekly Standards type neocon level,
she,
and then
yeah,
she went to
she
the
had a reaction against the 60s, against feminism, or feminists, you know, and also against Carter. It is a sort of common story. But the Rush thing was unusual because she is Jew, you know, she's just not, I don't know how to put it, she's not your typical, stereotypical Rush listener, and I was interested in your views on Rush because I read today an interesting article by John Derbyshire. I don't know if you looked at it. It was being linked around a lot today, and it was
I didn't see that. Yeah. I know Rush had a thing about women yesterday.
Yeah, the female summit, that? Right. No, this Derbyshire.
Female summit. What was it called? The EIB Network Female Summit, yeah.
Well, he has a gender gap, so he's facetiously trying to. Yeah, right. And all these women, he said, I want to hear from women who.
Yeah.
Don't like me, but of course, all the women who called in.
What can
like,
be done about this?
Like,
but
Derbyshire, it was a more expansive critique of Rush. And it was interesting because John Derbyshire, contributor to National Review, hard, you know, not very against comprehensive immigration reform, which was also a thing, a bailiwick of Rush's. But he wrote this article for the American Conservative magazine, which Andrew Sullivan sort of deliciously surmised was because they would not run it in National Review, which would have been interesting. And it was called How Radio Killed the Right. And he talks about basically, you know, Rush Limbaugh sort of appeals to this very lowbrow, fun conservatism, but, you know, to... He kind of makes the whole movement, the whole conservative movement, seem dumber and sort of like a middle school jokey thing when he uses feminazis and the drive-by media and that he contributes to the Joe Plumberization of the party. And he has an interesting
phrase. And he does a pretty good
phrase.
Job of ripping down the more intellectual conservatives and the way... I mean, he comes back very hard at those people and trashes them very well.
Right. And, you know, I think of, because my mother is, you know, the most intelligent person that I've ever met. She's just a brilliant woman, but she also, she has very strong opinions. And what she likes about Rush is that he's sort of, he's kind of hyperbolic and he takes pleasure in, you know, calling the feminists feminazis, et cetera. And, but a critique of Derbyshire.
He's not calling
was,
all feminists feminazis. I don't think he's anti-feminist. I think there's a certain type of feminist that he mocks that way. And he's very good at, you know, using language to make ideas nice and crisp and memorable. It's very effective and it's funny. There's enough truth in it, even when it's exaggerated, that you know what he's saying and you know why it makes sense to say that. I do. I listen to Rush.
Yeah, I know. I noticed I was watching a because I read your blog today, and you had linked a dialogue that you did with Emily Bazelon on Blogging Heads, and I watched part of it, and in it you were having a discussion about Rush's kind of spat with Obama, and how he and you were saying I think that Obama wanted to make Rush into this symbol that then he could drag down and demonize, whereas in fact this was unfair, and Rush was not that, you know, and you seem to, and I want you to mount a defense of Rush, because, you know,
I'm not sure what you're referring to from the Emily Bazelon thing, that Obama was trying, oh, Obama was telling people don't listen to Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, and that he was kind of cannily or cleverly using a tactic where he, you referred to Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, and you said there's,
right.
That he wants to isolate the enemy and polarize or whatever, but you did seem to have some sympathy, as you do now, for Rush, and, you know, look, I think Rush is funny.
Because Obama was trying to get this bipartisanism going and trying to co-opt the conservatives. I mean, this goes along with what I was saying before, that the Republicans need to define themselves and be something distinctive, be an alternative, and be part of a balance of power. I think there needs to be a separation of powers that is provided by the parties, that it can't be just one party getting everything that it wants and the other party just going along with it. You have to have some kind of definition. You need a two-party system. And I think that... when Obama said, don't listen to Rush Limbaugh, well, obviously he was trying to make the Republicans in Congress completely bland and completely undistinctive. And I think that that is dangerous. I think that you need to develop the thinking on the other side, not necessarily at the Rush Limbaugh level, but I think he's an important catalyst. I think he's important in keeping things crisp and fresh and defined.
But what about
I think he serves it. And it's also entertaining and funny. And my favorite thing that he does is when he plays sound bites from Democrats and then tells you what they're really saying. Then he paraphrases it back in his language. I think he's extremely effective when he does that, and very funny when he can actually impersonate the speaker, like Bill Clinton. He's very
funny. Oh, he does amazing Bill Clinton, and his songs about Bill Clinton were also really funny. But don't you think that there's a value in having separation of powers or a sort of differing poles within the Republican Party? And don't you think that the influence that he has right now intellectually on the party is unhealthy for the party and dangerous? And the New York Times magazine, you know, that big profile they did of him like a year back, he called himself the intellectual heart, or I think, of the Republican Party, something like that. And that's really true, and that's a pathetic thing.
Yeah, no, but here's the thing. Here's why I don't think he should back down. I think some other Republicans should step up and be strong. He is providing a model of strength and clarity and idea and ideas and communication. And it's not that he should step down. He's filling a void, and he will say that himself. The problem is that other Republicans just aren't good enough. And the idea that he should step back and let these mediocrities hold the stage when they have nothing to offer, I don't think he should. I think he should keep pushing, and somebody's got to step forward among the people who actually can hold political office. He doesn't aspire to political office, you know. Unlike some of these people like Chris Matthews, he doesn't want political office. He's doing his thing. He's providing a service. And the only reason he's the most, the biggest voice in the Republican Party is because the rest of them are such midgets.
That's a little bit of bullshit. I mean, he's kind of Jacobin in his way. I was looking at the transcript of what he said about Bobby Jindal, and he was very upset at the media's reaction to Bobby Jindal.
Yeah, me too. I was talking about Bobby Jindal. Bobby Jindal could be that guy that steps up.
So he said, but he said, okay.
There was such an effort to push Jindal back and say, oh, he was terrible. Everyone hates him. Oh, David Brooks hates him.
Yeah, well, he was
because
they're in
the same thing that was done to Sarah Palin. When somebody starts to come forward who really could be a leader in the party, the other side, of course, fighting back, tries to crush them into nothing. And the idea that the other Republicans are so lame that they just allow that to happen, that they allow the potential stars of their party to be destroyed by Democrats who are trashing them. I can't believe what's happening to Bobby Jindal. He totally didn't deserve that. That was ridiculous.
But Rush,
it's ridiculous. I agree with Rush Limbaugh.
But he is.
By the way, I'm trying to get Rush Limbaugh onto Blogging Heads. So if Rush is watching,
amazing.
I would
want
to.
Amazing.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Oh, that would be brilliant. No, but he is. Yeah. Look, I mean, to deny that he is an active factor in the fact that you can't cross him is ridiculous, and you know that's his right.
Well,
he's a media personality.
I didn't deny that.
He is very Jacobin.
He's saying other people need to be strong.
He said,
he's
you
strong
know,
and people need to be stronger.
But it's one thing to be strong, and it's another thing to say the following. People on our – so, you know, you have these Republicans like I was viewing Jindal's State of the Union response with my father – who's not, you know, a member of the drive-by media, and he thought it was terrible. I mean, people had a mixed reaction, let's put it that way, to Jindal, including conservatives. And Rush said, people on our side, I'm talking to you, those of you who think Jindal was horrible, in fact, I don't want to hear from you ever again if you think what Bobby Jindal said was bad or what he said was wrong. I mean, and Rush has this. He just, you know, if you don't agree with Rush, if you cross him, I think of that pathetic case of that Congressman Phil Gingrey, who recently complained to Politico.com about Rush. And Rush, you know, he's a little bit like one of these guys who does a video in the Middle East. I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, maybe. This might not be too temperate, but does a video and incites his supporters to go and bomb, you know. So Rush incited his supporters to do, like, a telephonic bomb on the on Phil Gingrey's office, saying, you know, you're in so much trouble, you can't complain about Rush or say you disagree with him. And Phil Gingrey, the poor guy, had to go sniveling and say, I think Rush is the conscience of the conservative movement. I mean, it was really a weak moment for that man.
Grow a pair. You know, I just think, so that guy is obviously weak. That's pathetic. Rush, if Rush can make people dance for him, That just shows how weak they are. I don't see the big problem. I think he's setting an example, showing how you can, and his biggest thing is just to have clear, strong, conservative principles. And he wants the Republicans to have conservative principles. And they won't do it. They're weak. They're manipulable. And he's just asking for some people to step up and be good. And he can't really punish them in any way. Why are they sniveling to him? It's embarrassing. They're pathetic.
Because he has...
But I think Bobby Jindal could be great. And Republicans need to look for the potential future stars and not... I mean, what did Bobby Jindal do wrong the other day? For one thing... People who do the response to the State of the Union, those are always lame. Response to the State of the Union, who is even watching it?
He was above and, he went good. Above and beyond in lameness, I will say
that. No, here's the thing. First of all, I played the race card, so I'm all prepared to play the race card on Bobby Jindal. I think people have some racial attitudes that I want to
What call, is the evidence for that? Lay that out.
Well, wait, but let me just say before that, that I think that... he was over-rehearsed, that somebody worked with him to get him to speak with a certain kind of clarity, and it wasn't really, it was a bad choice. I think he did.
Well, he should grow a pair, then, to use your language. I mean, he should reject. It was like Sarah Palin. She was obviously, I mean, I don't hold.
But we know Bobby Jindal is really smart. We know from his educational background. I mean, there are reasons to question that whether Sarah Palin is smart enough or well-educated enough. None of that is true with Bobby Jindal. He's also a very accomplished governor. He's done a lot. There's all kinds of reason to admire him. But I think that his speech was, it was on the Today Show the next day, and his speech was completely different. He was just over-rehearsed. Some speech shows. People worked with him, and they just had the wrong aesthetic idea.
Well, he should have had the courage. It wasn't even the aesthetics; it was the content.
So what's the big deal? It was one. He worked with some people, and it didn't quite work out right.
It was a big deal. It was his coming out party. It was his prom night.
I know, but
you look bad on your prom night. It's worse than if you look bad.
If you're going to just throw him out because he learned a way to give a speech, and there was a misjudgment about the best way to. I mean, I think that for one thing. He sounded to me like Al Gore. Al Gore always talks like that, as if you're in kindergarten. That was the problem, that he was being too clear. He seemed to think that the viewer was kind of dumb, and the viewer is kind of dumb, actually.
But people
were a little offended by that. It sounded a little I thought he sounded like an evangelist. I thought he sounded like a religious kind of a leader. That he was speaking in that, and he was, but what I actually liked him, I live blogged don't call it a State of the Union address and the Jindal response. I live blogged the whole thing, and I enjoyed Jindal despite the Al Gore-ish kind of talking to us like we're in kindergarten tone, because it was more confident and optimistic. And I thought that Obama was a big drag. Obama was sort of like a stern lecturer. Even when he was talking about hope, I felt like he was basically telling us how bad things were. And if we believe things are bad, it's only going to make things worse. I just feel like we're in a downward spiral of a lack of confidence in the economy. And I felt that Bobby Jindal's optimistic presentation was good. Now, everybody jumped all over him, and I felt like that was just a completely political attempt to, frame him, freeze him, define him, and get rid of him the way they did so effectively with the last potential star of the Republican Party, Sarah Palin, this idea of how to process any potential star out of the Republican Party has been, learned, and they aimed it at Bobby Jindal, and I think Rush was completely right to say, don't go along with that, defend this guy. He's a great potential star of the party. The fact that he delivered the speech in a tone that he was over-rehearsed to do, that's nothing. That's nothing. If the Republicans don't appreciate what they have in him, it's hopeless. Who else do they have? What else do they have? Look at this man's credentials. Look at what he's done.
I think you have
He's 37.
Yeah. I mean, I was amazed by the strength of my own feelings towards Jindal, and then the strength of the reaction. And I do agree that there was something odd in there. I mean, I think you have a little bit of a double standard. You were just complaining, grow a pair, about these Republicans who can't stand up to Rush and say, F you, Rush, mm-hmm. And then you say, well, we should be delicate. Jindal's a delicate flower.
No, not
right
delicate.
Now,
here's what I think, that as the Republican
Party
needs
to... Don't hold him
to
high standards yet, et cetera.
No, I'm not saying that. I do hold him to a high standard. I think he has a proven record and credentials that should make us very... If we care about the Republican Party building itself up as opposed to hoping it just goes into a complete eclipse and the Democratic Party takes over for God knows how long... I think if something is going to be rebuilt within the Republican Party, he has a lot of great potential. And I don't see him sniveling like that other character. I see him coming back the next day, presenting himself strongly. He needs to be in the spotlight more. He needs to be talking more, defining conservative values more. And, I'm not excusing him for talking in this kindergarten voice, but by the same token, wasn't Al Gore a relatively good politician who did a lot of things? And he always talked like that, and he never stopped, even when people criticized him over and over. I think Jindal is at least learning
and
from
it
that
hurt him.
Experience.
It hurt him. Yeah, Jindal ought to use that as a freaking example of how you go down in flames if you're... But look, it wasn't just the delivery. I think it's a little disingenuous to say that was the only complaint with him. I looked at... There was a Mike Gerson column, which was published, regrettably, the morning after the Jindal response, and it was written before Jindal gave his speech, and it kind of laid out what, knowing Jindal, and Mike Gerson, I think, is a big Jindal fan and has followed Jindal's career and has met Jindal, etc., knowing Jindal, what one would have reasonably expected from his State of the Union speech, which was, something... like a young guy, maybe a little bit green, so, maybe not the best delivery or whatever, but that there would be a stream, I think is what Gerson said, of policy ideas, that he does have this wonkish side, and that's part of his appeal, that he's not one of these kind of, like, Jim DeMint, whatever, just, like, reactionary, that he has these real policy chops. He ran the Medicare in Louisiana, et cetera. He has this interest in policy, A. B, that he's not reflexively anti-government grandstanding, which you have found to be a strain within the party right now. That's, again, the spending freeze. It's not really a good thing. And that, he said, part of this stimulus funding is inappropriate. I don't want it. But part of it, I think, is a useful function of government and is going to help my state. And we want that, et cetera. That he makes these distinctions. Mm-hmm. And the disconnect that you read, like reading this Gerson column the next morning, was that the speech was nothing like that. It was one long anti-government, sort of the Barry Goldwater, government has never done a thing that was, I want only less government, et cetera. And that was the whole parable with the sheriff, government doesn't work. And to me, the content, look, it was one speech. I still am impressed with Jindal. I like Jindal, but it was an unsettling, almost like Romney-ish moment of,
well,
what is this guy talking? He's sort of mouthing.
I think he got a fax from headquarters.
It wasn't.
I didn't particularly think Obama's speech was very good either. But I mean, these are these State of the Union things. The response to the State of the Union. I mean, his party is out of power. He's a governor. He's not even in Congress. So I mean, we know he's someone who comes up with these elaborate policy wonkish things and these whatever points of plans and so on. And it wasn't the choice was that wasn't a response to Obama. And then he's just laying out these sort of broad conservative principles. He's defining conservatism. I don't think the content, the actual words of these speeches matters that much. I think a lot of it is style. And obviously he had some problems with style. But I just think I'm just against this reflexive. Well, let me just play the race card because I'm dying to play.
I've been playing
the race card the last couple
because you
days.
Haven't played it yet.
Yeah, I did on my blog in a couple of posts, and I think that I sense in the response to Jindal, well, some of it is just let's destroy him because he's a Republican, let's deprive the Republicans of any potential star. But I think that there's some instinctive revulsion to him that makes me want to say not, I think you're a racist, but what makes you so sure when you express this kind of instinctive, I don't know what it is about that guy, but I don't like him. The way Chris Matthews muttered, oh, God, when he just saw him coming up before he'd even opened his mouth. It's sort of like, well, I don't like this. What is it? If there's someone of a different race that you see and you just have this sort of gut feeling that something's not quite right with him, I want to ask you to reflect and tell me why you're so confident that that's not coming from racism. I think people should be careful about that. I think people should be reflective about that.
Yeah, I don't
people
know.
People liked Obama. I just think that there was this. Did you see this Christopher Orr piece on how racial feelings helped Obama, but they won't help Jindal in the same way?
I did see that.
Did you see that piece? And he tried to explain it in these elaborate terms about how somehow when a black person is nerdy, it's cool, but South Asians are, there's so many of them who are nerdy that somehow it's not cool. It was like it was all beating around the bush in all kinds of weird ways. And I just ended up feeling that, you know, what are you really saying? And aren't you ashamed of that? It's sort of like, well, you like Barack Obama. Why? Because he served some sort of emotional need that white people have to associate and feel good about themselves and their association with black people. And then what is it about Jindal that isn't quite right? Well, I think the most obvious thing is that he's not a liberal. He's not giving the liberals what they want. He's not hewing to the service of white people properly. And so that's rejected. I just think there's a lot of racial emoting around this, and that people aren't willing to look into themselves and confront their own racial feelings and the way they use people of different races and the services that they expect them to perform and the limitations they impose on them. I think there's some very wrong things there, and I'm not accusing anybody specifically of being a racist. I'm just saying I think white people need to be more reflective on the subject and think hard about the way they're limiting people who aren't.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good point in the abstract. I mean, I think the problem with that theory is that there wasn't widespread revulsion at all towards Jindal. You know, you say people look at him, they've been looking at him, and they say something's just not right about that guy, something's off with that guy. Are you kidding? He's like the next hot thing. Everyone loves him. People who meet him are impressed with him. He's
Well, I was looking at Josh Marshall. I was looking at Andrew Sullivan. Obviously, there's the Chris Matthews saying, oh, God.
It was just, well, that, I don't know what was with that. That was weird. But Chris Matthews,
he saw me,
I mean,
said,
there's so many things one can't explain
those
about
weird
him.
Things.
But beyond that, I mean, it was just this. It was just a speech. It was a speech, which was a deeply weird speech. I'm sorry.
I just want people to be alert. And there actually is a pretty long tradition in the United States of not allowing a non-white person, not accepting a non-white person being conservative.
Yeah, I think, that's true. That's true. And I favor alertness. And I think, you know, I just want people to be Michael Steele, and I think he's making a fool of himself with his, like, off-the-hook stuff right now. On the other hand, I think he's being open to more ridicule because of that, because he's a black conservative. But, you know, I think with Jindal, people have loved Jindal. And the history, you know, political meltdowns can happen in an instant and just have this collapse, and suddenly people look in at someone and they feel revulsion. You think of Howard Dean and The Scream. Now, why, you know, and there's a lot of factors. It's like an avalanche, and there's been all these air pockets that have been building up and you haven't been able to see it. And so it seems like there's this instant revulsion, but actually it had to do with the fact that the Dean bubble was bursting. And, you know, I think Jindal went in and the expectations were too high, and
he had to come down to earth a little, but he can build himself back up.
He can build himself back up. We had posts on our blog saying, you know, Jindal's, stick a fork in Jindal. He's toast, right? But, you know, I think there's second chances.
But you don't
chances.
Stick a fork in toast. If you stick a fork in toast, you could get electrocuted. You stick a fork in
I've done that, right. Yeah.
Don't stick a fork in the toast.
Did I say that? Well, I'm getting carried away.
I'm just trying to save you from electrocution. Well, you know, we're getting close to the end of our time, and we wanted to throw in a sexy topic, and I found one tonight, so should we switch to that?
Absolutely.
There was this article in the Daily. Do you read the Daily Beast?
I've just started because I don't read a ton of websites. I'm a little Luddite, I have to admit. But people have been recommending it to me and saying, you know, it's a good sort of aggregator.
Well, let's introduce it to people with this article by Tracy Kwan called Kinkonomics. I have to preface this by saying I'm a little worried that some of these style stories are made up. And the New York Times had an article that just was in the zone for them about, you know, women and their rich dates and the economy's collapse and so on. It was about something called Dating a Banker Anonymous. And then it turned out to be a satire and basically fictional. And they had to, you know, they were embarrassed by that. So I'm not so sure that this Kinkonomics thing isn't just another, you know, sex and the economic problem. If we can get those two together, we have the perfect storm. But I'm going to throw it
so
out
much
anyway.
Because like, everyone has been trying to find a sex angle in the economic meltdown. I'm not going to comment in too much because I know the author and she's done amazing work from the Republic of Georgia. She's a really adventurous female writer for the Washington Post, Tara Barampour. But this article, I have to regretfully say, was like totally ludicrous. I mean, and it was basically she went around to bars, like the 18th Street Lounge, which is this sort of hip bar in D.C., and asked men if they felt emasculated dating-wise because of the economy. And it was just like, it was so forced, and the quotes were so kind of predictable. It's like, but why even try for this? But the
Kinkonomics. Well, because the economy is so important, and yet we're getting bored by the subject. So we can't really drop it. So it's sort of like, how can we get sex into it?
Right.
but this one, this Tracy Kwan Kinkonomics thing is a very good, I feel like it must, it seems fictional to me just because it's so perfect. It says, as the economy takes a spanking, many women are turning to freelance fetish work to supplement their incomes. And this is about freelancing as a dominatrix. And, it, you know, it says many freelance dominatrixes prefer to work a regular shift in a commercial dungeon with equipment and advertising provided by management. So it's about sort of like the commercial enterprise that is a dungeon, and the women who are sort of maybe freelancing in some, tech job during the day, then use their extra hours to make $80 an hour in some commercial dungeon being a dominatrix. That's happening, according to this article.
Yeah.
what a go.
Yeah, I mean, this article, it kind of rehashes the Daniel Bergner sort of fetish stuff. I have to admit that it's stopping being titillating to me. Like, I just really haven't heard about a fetish recently, you know, that really even surprises me anymore. But I also felt, I mean, the quotes in this article, it's an interesting article.
Do they seem manufactured to you?
They seem, well, I'll read you one. I wasn't really that interested, unquote, in S&M, says Chloe. Quote, I got involved because it was easy money. The strap-on, I'm okay with it, but it's not really a personal interest of mine. I don't know. Did you ever say that? I don't know. The strap-on, it's not really a personal interest. It's like so kind of ironic and it's so perfect, but, you know.
As a woman who's understandably proud to have a very particular foot with a high arch.
Right, right. You know, there was Condé Nast portfolio polled its readers, and I blogged about this a couple of times. It was so fascinating to me. They did a poll of their readers, which are obviously not like a wide spectrum of the American populace, but they're the Condé Nast portfolio readers. And the poll was on which things they were starting to do to make more money, or, you know, in light of the economic situation, to bulk up their savings, whatever. And of course, the top one was cease eating out at restaurants. We know that restaurants are really hurting almost the worst. And obviously, you know, this wasn't a scientifically done scientific methodology survey. Different people who would have answered were in different levels of economic need, etc. But there was a funny, it was like such a weird hierarchy. So something like 5% said that they were considering or had already like sold their eggs. And then only 2% said that they would be willing to give up the household made, and only 1% said that they were considering stopping having their professional hair treatments at the salon. And it was just a sort of, you know, that these kinds of, I guess selling eggs and doing fetish work are really not in the same category, except that they're kind of giving of your body, and that there is a sort of like, hey, it's apocalypse times. I guess might as well get some kicks.
Well, I think it's a way to make money. I don't think it's really very pleasurable for the person who's doing the job, is it?
I guess it depends on your point of view.
I mean, I would think that this is actually for commercial sex purpose. I think that as far as commercial sex goes, this is the one that makes the most sense, because I think it's the thing that your actual love partner would be least likely to be willing to do.
Because, right? Well, and it's also...
I mean, what kind of a woman would want a man that wanted that?
It's also probably very sort of alienating. Like, you can almost imagine you're a different person because you're doing something so different than you would normally find yourself doing in your own bedroom. It's like you could really kind of disaggregate and disconnect your sexual persona in the dungeon versus your sexual persona at home, I expect. Although I wonder, you know.
Also, you just couldn't respect your partner at all.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's about
respect.
Couldn't
do that
with
your
real partner. It's about a power hierarchy in these situations.
Well, I mean, that's why you have to be paid for it. You wouldn't actually enjoy a relationship like that. You wouldn't enjoy the relationship with the other person, right?
You know, there was an article, and I'll figure it out, and it'll be posted next to this Diavlog, but it was a long article, and it was in one of these places like the Times Magazine, and it was like 5 years ago. But it was about a woman who was a dominatrix, and she specialized in men who receive sexual enjoyment from dressing like babies and being like spanked in diapers, you know, and really going all the way, like,
yes,
with pacifiers.
Yes,
and she had like sort of intricate and complicated relationships with some of her devoted clients, where she really felt maternal towards them. She felt like she knew them. She felt like she had a sort of, yeah, like a relationship with them. And it was surprising because you're like, oh, these people are just sort of tradespeople. Like, you know, they just wham, bam, literally. Like, you step on one guy's face and then he goes, you know, step on another guy's face. It's all in the course of an hour, right? But I think this article kind of turned that on its head. So.
But my point is that if it weren't a commercial relationship, if people actually had to find a friendly partner who would do it for nothing because they were actually enthusiastic about doing it, I would think that men couldn't find women who would want to have a relationship like that. Free relationship, a love relationship. That's not something.
Probably it's not. I mean, because then why do people pay for it? You know,
People pay for a prostitute to have regular old sex of the sort that people do enthusiastically for free, right? Mm-hmm. But you pay so you can get a partner.
Right.
But you might be able to get a real partner who would do that with you for fun, for true love.
One would hope.
Right?
Yeah.
But I don't think you could get someone to do this as an actual relationship.
I don't
know. Maybe some people would, but it seems to me that if that's what you really, if that's your actual sexual need, you probably need to go pay for that.
It's very rare. I mean, this writer, Dan Bergner, I think is his name, mm-hmm. and he just mm-hmm. wrote this book called The Other Side of Desire, which has been mm-hmm. much discussed. And it contains a portrait of a man who holds some respectable job as like a lawyer, even maybe in government. And he.
You call that respectable?
You're right. Yeah. Not a big surprise, but, gotta get that joke in there somewhere. Anyway, he is only sexually attracted to amputees.
Yeah.
And he found and had
like Paul McCartney, right?
But, ching. That didn't work out so well, though. Yeah, he's got burned on that one.
Well, it didn't work out. You know, they had that divorce and she hopped all over him.
Oh, yeah, right. She really stumped him. I was going to get in trouble for that joke. That was bad. But look, he had a marriage.
We're recording this late at night, so
yeah,
you have to forgive us.
Please, it's like freaking past 10. Sorry.
Look, I've been drinking straight vodka.
Oh, great. But anyway, he had a 20-year marriage with an amputee. And it was, you know, so this was a love relationship, and he felt like he really respected this woman, and it just happened.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah, so, you know, but I think he was also tormented by questions like, is this kind of a weird arrangement that we have, because she's an amputee and has trouble finding men, and then I'm a man who only cares about amputees, and is there, you know, but I just figure that's addressed.
So that was established before they met, and he pursued her because of that. It wasn't
yes.
that he loved her and then no. that became something about her, so he loved it because it was about her. That would be different from if he started out loving that thing and then found her because she fulfilled it.
No, he found her on like an amputee chat board or something.
Yeah, that's kind of bad.
It's kind of bad. I mean, it's also just a drastically narrowed, you know, I mean, it's like a really narrowed version of J-Date. You know, he knows he only wants to be with women who are amputees, and so he's starting from that point. You're not buying it.
Well, what am I not buying? I mean, I think there's something a little bad about that, but maybe he can grow into a fully formed human being.
Maybe. I'll hold out hope. it being past 10 and past
hey, we went an
my
hour.
Legal
we go an hour.
Past my legal blood alcohol
it's
limit.
Past your bedtime.
we should probably
okay,
draw
it was really
a
fun. So you're going to leave the country. You're going off on a.
I am. I am going
tell
off.
Tell us about that. Does that mean you're not going to be on Blogging Heads anymore?
Well, if we do, we could do African World Cup Blogging Heads. I hope I could occasionally be on Blogging Heads. For,
but you're going to be in Africa.
A world topic. I'm going to be in South Africa. That's correct. On a writing grant. So,
cool.
Cheerio, House Republicans. I'll miss you. I hope that you've cleaned your shit up when I get back. So.
Well, have a great African sojourn.
Thank you. Wonderful to talk with you, Anne.
Nice to talk with you.
All right.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay.